Good morning. I'm WILL-TV Program Director David Teal, your guest host for the 11 o'clock hour of Focus 580. Last week, Director Ken Burns's The National Parks, America's Best Idea, aired on PBS and WILL-TV, bringing new attention to the story of how our country came to preserve its natural wonders for the enjoyment of all. But even at 12 and a half hours in length, it didn't have room for everything. This morning, our guest will be talking about what the series didn't cover. Dr. Robert Parr is a professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Urbana. He's taught classes on environmental politics and policy, as well as the politics of wildlife and wilderness in the Yellowstone area. You're welcome to call in with your questions and comments this morning. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the area, anywhere in the U.S., you can use our toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Bob Parr, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Good to be here. So, well, let's get right into it. What didn't Ken Burns tell us last week?
Well, first of all, we should talk about what he did tell us, in 12 and a half hours. And I should put in a plug for WILL, which is still hosting these segments. If you missed any of them, they're available on websites and on the PBS website till the end of the week.
Thanks for the plug.
He gave us a really heroic vision of the national park system. It was built around individuals like John Muir. We saw a lot of John Muir. And it was built around the most famous two parks, Yellowstone and Yosemite, which are also the first two parks with the exact pride of place, depending a little bit on how you define first. And he emphasized, of course, our relationship with the parks. And like other Ken Burns films, he emphasized the role of parks in American culture and American identity and the way that they fit into how we think of ourselves as a people. So if you think of that, what he didn't tell us would be the flip side is, what didn't I just say? About half of all the segments on the website I checked were about Yellowstone or Yosemite. Well, there's almost 400 parks in the system, so that means almost 400 parks that he didn't tell that much about, and a lot of those are interesting and important parks. He gave us heroic stories about individuals who lobbied for individual parks. Some parks didn't have individuals that lobbied for them. They were created as a result of groups that worked together without an individual leader. One, Mount Rainier National Park, would be a famous early example. Mm-hmm. The Seattle Mountaineering Community and the Seattle Chamber of Commerce and the Tacoma Chamber of Commerce were the main lobbyists without any kind of hero. And things that aren't about people he didn't spend a lot of time on. He didn't talk a lot about the wildlife and the nature of the parks except the way that people relate with the nature. So if you think about what he did do and then flip that upside down, those are the kinds of elements that fell outside his artistic vision.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, in my notes here, you said that he doesn't really tell the environmental story as well as he tells the people story. So I mean, we think of the national parks as a place to go, on vacation or, mm-hmm. or whatever, but we don't always think about, the environmental issues or what else the parks are giving us.
Right, and some of them are absolutely essential places for individual species. Mm-hmm. There are species that are found only in a particular park.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are essential for biodiversity. The Great Smoky Mountains, for example, is a globally important hotspot because it's the northernmost place that glaciers didn't reach because there's a lot wide range of elevations and because there's wet sides, dry sides, and all sorts of other different kinds of habitats. The Smokies have an extraordinary wealth of species and are important for that, regardless of whether we visit them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the most important plants and animals of the Smokies are things like salamanders that, mm-hmm. Are not heroic like bison and elk and wolves. they're salamanders, but the Smokies are an extremely important place for salamanders.
Hmm.
And, he didn't tell us about that.
Sure, sure. Well, they're not quite as photogenic as the wolves, although, they've got a story to tell. So
they do.
So that's one thing. And, I was reading up on this and it seems that there's a lot of talk now about how the parks are having to change or cope with climate change and the environmental impact of that on some of these species, like the salamanders, I imagine.
Yeah, that's true. Any There's a number of parks that face significant threats of all sorts of kinds, and we can talk about some of those threats. The climate change is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
If climate change comes through as predicted, Glacier National Park will not have glaciers by 2030.
Mm-hmm.
Joshua Tree National Park in California might not have Joshua trees.
Hmm.
And there's a number of other parks like that, that just as the climate changes, the reason that they were originally established may disappear. And climate change also affects, of course, the animals that live in parks. One of the areas that people are most worried about climate change is Yellowstone, the famous park, and in particular the grizzlies. Grizzlies wake up from hibernation and they eat whatever died during the winter. Right? Climate change is going to affect who dies and when they die. Right? Then the grizzlies move on to cutthroat trout, which are spawning.
Mm-hmm.
Climate change is going to affect the temperature of the water, which affects the spawning, and is going to affect that food source. Later on, they move to eat army cutworm moths, which migrate there from the Great Plains. So anything that screws up the climate in Yellowstone or in the Great Plains is going to affect that food source. Then they end up eating white bark pine nuts, and white bark pine are in the highest elevation areas and would be threatened by climate change that changes the temperature of the highest elevation areas. And so each of those food sources for grizzly bears as they wake up and then fatten up before hibernation would be threatened by climate change.
Now, before the show, we were talking about this too. The grizzly bears have gone back on the endangered list. Is that correct?
They are in Yellowstone. The endangered – or in the Yellowstone area, the endangered species list, or really endangered and threatened species list,
mm-hmm.
Is not – it isn't necessarily organized around all the grizzlies in the world, because there's lots of grizzlies in the world,
mm-hmm.
or lots of wolves. It's organized around what are called distinct population segments.
Mm-hmm.
And the Yellowstone population of wolves and grizzlies is not connected to other wolves or grizzlies. So sometimes they can be on the list there even though they're off the list in other areas,
mm-hmm.
Just because they're not connected, and so you don't have gene flow and animal flow.
Was it the climate change affecting them there, or is it other factors that
This is people.
It's people.
Okay. The grizzly population has grown quite a bit, and so the grizzlies are wandering out. And as you wander out, you start to bump up against people,
mm-hmm.
That live in the towns around. Grizzlies will eat they eat elk calves, and they'll eat cow calves and other animals in the spring too. So ranchers have concerns, as well as just people that might not want a grizzly bear walking through a playground in the town or something like that.
Yeah, that seems reasonable enough.
Yeah.
The parks, I mean, I guess how were the park areas selected? I mean, was it really for their natural beauty, or was it because of environmental concerns, or we need to protect this particular forest or that?
It was really not chosen for environmental concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's one of the major weaknesses of the U.S. park system. Because it's the oldest, it was created to serve the way people thought about the environment in the late 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
Or late 1800s, I'm sorry, the late 19th century. So people thought in terms of scenic beauty, the spectacular beauty of Yosemite Valley, or the geysers of Yellowstone,
mm-hmm.
Which are half the world's thermal features, and so on, as Ken Burns showed us. And as he showed us the scenic beauty of park after park, one result of that is that we ended up preserving a lot of different habitats and a lot of different ecosystems.
Mm-hmm.
But they tend to be the ecosystems that are in higher elevation places, or they're places like the Badlands or
mm-hmm.
Theodore Roosevelt that are hard or impossible to live in.
Right.
Right. So we do a pretty good job of preserving those kinds of environments, and a pretty bad job of preserving the kinds of environments where we actually do live. So if you think of the tall grass prairies of Illinois and Iowa, there's no national park. There's a small tall grass prairie park in Kansas, but there's nothing on the scale of Yellowstone or Yosemite preserving that, or lowland habitats on the East Coast.
Hmm.
That's all developed, right?
Right.
So we don't preserve those kinds of habitats. And there's a number of others. It's a miracle that we ended up preserving the Everglades in the face of development.
Well, I do want to remind listeners, or at least let, if you've joined us late, let you know that we're talking this morning with Dr. Robert Parr, Bob Parr, professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Urbana. We're talking about the politics of America's national parks and what Ken Burns didn't cover in last week's National Parks television series. You can call in with your questions and comments at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And then you can use our toll-free line outside the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere in the continental U.S., 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. So, what else do you feel that, that the program missed out on?
Well, moving away from the environment for a minute, one thing that I would highlight is he mentioned the historical parks. So he had... He showed a couple of events that took place in the Washington Mall, for example, which is a national park. We don't think of it as a national park.
Right.
And there's lots of other historic sites that are national parks, the Lincoln sites in Springfield, the historic sites in Boston, Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, and so forth. He didn't talk about those. He mentioned a little bit of the battlefield parks, only mentioned the Civil War battlefields. And...
Well, that is a topic for him. He likes
it. Of course. And of course, the Civil War made him famous, and it's understandable. Those have been very politically controversial. Not so much setting them up, but it used to be that the Civil War battlefield parks would not mention in the visitor centers slavery. They tend to be in the South, and if a park superintendent put up an exhibit about slavery, he would immediately get 2,000 letters and complaints. He'd hear from the local congressman. He'd hear from the local chamber of commerce, the local town, the county, or whatever else. Some superintendents got death threats for putting slavery in the visitor center and saying slavery was a cause of the Civil War, because, of course, there are people that feel very strongly about this issue. Some years ago, fairly recently, Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. actually passed a law or sponsored a law that passed requiring that the Park Service mention the causes of the Civil War in the Civil War parks. He didn't force them to say slavery, but he did force them to mention the causes of the war. And the Park Service went through an exercise to find out what those causes were. Of course, it's a complex war. There's lots and lots of causes. But the result of that study was that the number one cause, according to the Park Service experts, was slavery.
And so they did post it finally?
So now they are putting it in the national parks. But again, you can imagine the state rights people in the South. There are people that feel very strongly about that issue. And so the politics there has been very interesting. A parallel area that's politically interesting also is the Native American battlefields, which is the other big group of battlefields. And I don't think he mentioned any of them. Some of them – one of them is Custer's Last Stand, which was renamed by Congress as Little Big Field Battlefield Park – sorry, Little Bighorn Battlefield Park as part of an attempt to tell both sides of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. That was extremely controversial. We did meet the superintendent who had to carry out that decision of Congress, Gerard Baker, who appeared in the first two nights. He looks Native American and he's from the Mandan in North Dakota braids, if viewers remember him. He was the superintendent, the first Native American superintendent of any park, and he was given the task of overseeing this name change and change in interpretation at the Little Bighorn Battlefield. Which led to major political controversies, a splitting up of the Parks Association, Supportive Association, into three groups, political involvement in how to tell that story. The end result is that Little Bighorn looks like the Civil War parks. It treats both the U.S. Cavalry and the Native Americans as Americans, just like we treat both the Union and the Confederacy as Americans. But it took 15 years. To make that transition.
It seems like any time you get public funds involved, I mean, it seems like there's always kind of a big brouhaha about what's covered, what's not covered.
Right. And the parks are part of that. It's the current brouhaha, now that Little Bighorn has been recast, is the Nez Perce parks in the Northwest. If you remember Chief Joseph fleeing from Oregon and trying to get to Canada, there are six or seven battlefields along that trail that are all national parks. And again, it used to be told solely from the standpoint of the U.S. Cavalry, and they're now recasting all of those parks. The local community has been more accepting of that change than the Custer's Last Stand folks who feel very strongly about General Custer.
What about there are still Native American tribes living in some of the parks, right?
Yeah, in a very there are Native Americans next to a lot of parks.
Oh, okay.
Like Glacier National Park in Montana has the Blackfoot Indian Reservation on the east side and the Flathead Indian Reservation on the west side. That's very common. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of tribes that actually live inside the park or partially inside the park, the Tishimba Shoshone in Death Valley, after fighting for most of the 20th century, got rights to stay on the land that they had been in, which is near the park headquarters. There's two tribes in and around the Grand Canyon, the Havasupai and the Hualapai, who, you know, again, are in or immediately next to the park and try to maintain something like a traditional life while also hosting a lot of tourists who hike down to visit their campsites or stay in their lodge and so forth. And he didn't tell those stories. Mm-hmm. He preferred to focus on the historical side of Native Americans as if, you know, he talked about the way the land was taken from them, but he didn't talk about ongoing relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But they're part of the local communities, just like Estes Park is part of Rocky Mountain National Park.
Right.
It's the local community.
Yeah. I've spent a lot of time in Estes Park over the years.
Yeah.
Beautiful place. I guess the Native American images in the national parks, and do they try to represent accurately what Native American culture is like, or is it kind of for the tourists? Is it?
The visitor centers that I've been to that do this, in fact, Grand Tetons recently built a brand new visitor center, which is a beautiful center. And when I was there with this class that I taught on site last year, we looked for this to see how the Native Americans were treated. And they're mentioned, but they're mentioned as historical. In historical terms, these were the first residents of Jackson Hole, the first residents of the park. And some visitor centers are explicit about how they were displaced, and some visitor centers kind of gloss over why they're not here.
Mm-hmm.
The museums tend to do traditional crafts. So they might say, here are examples of the traditional clothing, the traditional lifestyle. They tend not to talk about ongoing relations. And yet some of those are politically important. I mean, I can mention two. One would be Badlands National Park, which consists of two major units, a north unit and a south unit. South unit is in the middle of Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, which is the poorest Indian reservation in the country. Pine Ridge would like to manage the park. and there is a process right now that's going on about how to discuss that. Should the Park Service manage it with input from Pine Ridge? Should Pine Ridge manage it with input from the Park Service? Could we co-manage it?
Mm-hmm.
The National Park Service has a lot of technical expertise about managing parks and archaeological resources. Pine Ridge tends not to have that technical expertise. So even if you gave them authority, you'd want to think about what the Park Service could contribute. So that's very much a live issue. Those are people that not only live next to a park but actually surround a park, and the park is on their reservation. Another one, which is not too far away, is Yellowstone and the bison. Yellowstone has a lot of bison, some of which are diseased. And as a result of the management of the bison, which is a complicated issue, the Park Service often rounds up bison, which about 70 tribes around the United States would like to get.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the bison may or may not be infected with brucellosis. So transporting them interstate onto an Indian reservation to add to a herd where they might infect an existing herd obviously raises public health issues, as well as questions about whose animals the bison are. But that, too, is a political controversy where Yellowstone National Park has actually been very lousy about talking to the tribes about this, whereas their neighbors in Wind River in South Dakota has been very good about talking to the local tribes about how to deal with their bison surplus.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another example of the politics of parks, in this case, again, involving Native Americans, locals, that Ken Burns wasn't talking to us about because he wanted to focus on the historical identity issues.
Right. I do want to remind our listeners we are talking with Bob Parr about the politics of the national parks and what Ken Burns didn't tell us in last week's television series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea. The telephone number, of course, is 333-9455. And, of course, outside the Champaign-Urbana area, our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. You know, that America's Best Idea. Now, I originally thought that was an editorial comment by Ken Burns, but that was actually what Wallace Stegner, I believe, right? Who had said that. Do you agree with that kind of central premise that this is, you know, the best idea we ever came up with, or at least a darn good one?
It's certainly a darn good one. He started the film with that phrase and then immediately went to one of his talking heads. And I've forgotten which talking head it was. A talking head said, certainly it was a really great idea, but he wanted to give pride of place to Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence is America's best idea. And certainly that's a reasonable alternative answer. But certainly national parks is one of our best ideas, and it's a distinctive one.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that other countries had come up with. A lot of the national parks were imagined in counterpoint to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And in Europe, large pieces of land that were preserved for hunting were owned by royalty, or large landowners. Some of those have since become parks. There are a lot of hunting preserves, royal hunting preserves, that are now game parks or the European equivalent of national parks. They come in four or five different flavors. So a lot of times they're parks that allow hunting, for example.
We have a caller on Line 1 from Champaign. Good morning, Line 1.
Yeah, good morning. Very interesting talk. And having attended a number of national parks, both the historic and natural parks, I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to the politics of loving the parks too much. And in particular, I'm curious to know about some of the proposals that have been efforts to reduce the amount of car exhaust that might be present in a park that are doing damage to the natural environment. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, this has been... I mean, Ken Burns did mention that issue of loving the parks too much and mostly talked about it in the last evening with reference to Mission 66. And this was, again, as Burns tells the story, after World War II, Americans fell in love with the parks and visitation went up extraordinarily rapidly and put a lot of pressure on the infrastructure. And in honor of the or in anticipation of the 50th anniversary, the Park Service came up with a plan of dealing with that increased visitation in the parks. And this included lots of road building, lots of building of visitor centers, lots of hotels, and then a lot of things that are on that you see behind the scenes, sewage treatment plants, sewage ponds, landfills, garbage collection infrastructure. I mean, a number of the parks have what are essentially small towns or towns of 5,000 or more people that spring up for the summer season and then drift away. And that's a lot of impact. And one thing that I'd like to think about or have all Americans think about is how much of that stuff needs to take place in the park and how much of that stuff can take place just outside. So Rocky Mountain National Park is a nice example. There are no hotels in the park. Right? The hotels are in Estes Park on the east side or in Grand Lake on the west side. And there are roads. There are a couple of roads into the park. And then there's one road that goes entirely through the park, Trail Ridge Road.
Right.
Having people lodge outside the park is great, and it's easy for people to get inside the park. And we even have public transportation that lets them get inside the park now. Given that we have public transportation that gets them into the park, how many people need to take their cars? How much of that road infrastructure can we reduce? Right? Still, the buses would need the roads.
Right.
When do we have roads that are parallel existing roads? Yellowstone has a road that parallels the existing road between Mammoth Hot Springs and Gardner. It's the old Stagecoach Road, and it's unpaved. You can still drive it. Why do we need it? It's paralleling the existing paved road down the hill. There's another road on the Blacktail Plateau. So Ken Burns finished the film talking about restoration and reintroducing wolves and trying to restore the parks. And it would be great to think about what else can we restore? How many of these roads and visitor centers and hotels can be moved just outside, with Estes Park as a nice example? And in how many cases can we use public transportation to get inside to minimize that? Yosemite has a public transportation system. Grand Canyon has a public transportation system. Rocky Mountain does. The Smokies, which is our most visited park, does not. Could we do it there? And so forth. And that's something that Ken Burns could have talked about. I wish he had. He tended to like to celebrate all the good things instead of talking about the challenges of traffic and roads and pollution and so forth.
And I've been to Rocky Mountain National Park a number of times, Estes Park, and there are a lot of cars there. I've taken the ride up Trail Ridge Road, and yeah, there's a lot of cars going way up into the mountains there.
Right.
Some of them stalling out.
And a lot of bikers too.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I like to ask is, what if we re-envision Trail Ridge Road not as an automobile road, but as a mountain biking trail? That would be really hard because a lot of Americans want to be able to drive up to 12,000 feet and see a tundra environment.
Right.
As opposed to biking up, which would be physically
be
very challenging.
Very, very challenging. I don't think I'd be doing that one, because as it is, it's quite steep by car. So.
Right. But we could have horses. And, of course, people climb those mountains and hike up them.
Sure.
So, those would be conversations I'd love to have about individual park because each park is different, really by definition.
Talking about, one thing I guess we want to talk about is the areas of the parks that don't have the roads and all that. There's vast tracts of the national parks that are not pristine, but at least not well traveled, don't have paved roads in them.
Oh yeah, very much so. And it varies by park and by location.
Mm-hmm.
And Yellowstone has the spot in the lower 48 states that is the farthest from any paved road, any road at all. It's about 25 miles from any road, and it's in the southwest corner of the park in the thoroughfare region. I suppose if you're a really fast hiker, you could get there in a day, 25 miles along. You're following the river, so it's fairly flat. Most people take 2 days to get there. So it's nice to know that there's a place that takes 2 days to get to away from a road that's 25 miles from the nearest road. And if you remember, you know, your grade school geometry, that means that the area around it would be pi r squared, where the radius of that area is 25 miles. Can't do that calculation in my head.
I can't either.
But that's a big chunk of land.
Sure.
And Yellowstone has that. Other large parks have places like that. The Smokies, which are the closest big park to Champaign, have one road that goes up the middle of them, but on both the northeast and the southwest side of that road, it's largely wilderness. Not as big as the Yellowstone wilderness, but a lot of space without roads. And again, biologically very important and environmentally very important.
We will give out the phone number one more time. It's 333-9455. And of course, out of the area, 800-222-9455. You're welcome to call in with your questions and comments about the national parks for Bob Parr from the University of Illinois. The wilder areas, the roadless areas, I mean, now they're kind of under assault too, right? I mean, logging interests, other interests perhaps.
Or people that love them too much. So, for example, one of the most popular mountains to climb in Rocky Mountain National Park is Long's Peak.
Right.
It's the highest mountain in the park.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't climbed it myself, but I've climbed the mountain right next door to it because I'd rather climb without crowds. But I came down that trail, the trail that goes up Long's Peak. And when you come down to an area called the Boulder Field, which is at about 12,500 feet, there are two solar-powered composting toilets. And now if you think about that for a minute, that means that there's enough hikers and climbers that have gone at that point about 5 miles, 3,000 feet up to get to that spot that they have to worry about the impact of humans answering nature's call in nature.
Sure.
And so they have these, and I don't know the biology of solar-powered composting toilets, but that is what they are, and they're designed to deal with this loving the parks too much. And for me, that's a symbol of how even backcountry users have an impact on the nature that they're there to see.
Sure. Well, we've got some calls lined up now, so we'd love to talk to Line 1 in Champaign. Line 1, good morning.
Yeah, hi. Actually, there's two points here. What were they, all-terrain vehicles or whatever they call those things that run through the parks? Is that what they're called or not?
Well, the all-terrain vehicles or off-road vehicles are a big issue in a lot of preserved areas, especially in the West. They're not so common in the national parks except for snowmobiles. Okay. Which are off-road vehicles, of course.
Because Bush was very favorable toward that. And I think, wasn't that rescinded or some rather, fast development or some rather recently?
The snowmobile issue. The snowmobile issue has been going on since the 1980s. And when you voted for president in 2008, you might not have known that you were voting for whether or not snowmobiles would be in Yellowstone Park. But it's been very true in these 20 years that under Republican presidents, snowmobiles are in, and under Democratic presidents, snowmobiles are out. It's a purely partisan issue.
Well, that's a good reason why to vote Democratic. Okay, thanks a lot.
Sure.
All right, thank you. And then we have another caller from Champaign on Line 2. Line 2, good morning.
Yeah, here's something that may not be per se an aesthetic value or feature of the parks we have now, but I believe that in some legislation passed, it may have been the stimulus package, that Republican Senator Coburn out of Oklahoma slipped into it, and the Democrats didn't have the courage to vote it out because they wanted the overall bill to pass. And that is the right of Americans, or I guess anyone who visits the park, to carry guns. Am I right on that?
Yes, you are. It's the Park Service, the rule is that the parks, you can carry guns in the parks subject to state law. So, for example, our nearest big national park to Champaign would be Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore in Indiana, or a little further afield, Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. So if you wanted to carry a gun into those parks, you'd be subject to whatever Indiana law or Kentucky law is.
Does Illinois have a national park? In, say, southern Illinois?
Or? We have a lot of national park units. There are 58 national parks that have the word park in the title. There are almost 400 units. All the Abraham Lincoln sites in Springfield, those are national park units. They just don't have the national park name in them.
Okay, but nothing like Yosemite or Yellowstone.
No, the close.
There's something down in southern Illinois. When I drive down the SIU, was the Shawnee?
Shawnee National Forest.
Right.
Right. We have the Shawnee, and we have a number of national wildlife refuges, which are mostly along the rivers to preserve a lot of migratory birds that use rivers.
Well, let me just go back to my original question. Sort of going to put you on the hook here since you're an expert. What's your notion about whether it's good public policy to allow people to bring guns in the park, even though it may be subject to a restrictive or maybe non-restrictive state law? What is your idea? Is that good public policy, or was that good public policy?
I would say it's going to depend somewhat on the parks and why people want to carry guns. Some people want to carry them for public safety. And there are some parks with crime problems. We have some urban parks like Golden Gate in San Francisco or Gateway in New York. And we also have a lot of these big open rural parks. The problem with guns in those big, more natural parks is if people have guns, it's really easy to poach.
Okay.
And it's also very easy for people to say that they're shooting a wolf or a bear in self-defense, even when they were shooting it for sport.
All right.
And areas, other countries that allow guns in parks have found that people with guns get attacked by animals more than people without guns, or say they get attacked more than people without guns. And I would expect that to happen in our big parks, too.
All right. Well, thank you, Line 2. We've got another caller from Champaign on Line 3. Line 3, good morning.
Yes. Hi. I have one comment and one question. I'm glad you're bringing up the whole concept of impact on the national parks by people and visitors and all. And sadly, people are not a low-impact species. And it seems as if, that all over the world, regardless if it's a park or not, we have very high ecological impact on the other creatures we share the planet with. But that aside, my question is are there any plans for any national parks coming on, I mean new ones, to be brought in whatever into our park system? I'm particularly talking about national parks on the scale of something like a Yellowstone, not like a Lincoln Memorial, but
right.
a big national wildlife area kind of thing.
The biggest one that's sort of on deck, and it's very politically difficult, would be grasslands.
Oh, yes.
Okay, we don't preserve prairie habitat. The only prairie parks we have are two Badlands parks, Badlands in South Dakota and Theodore Roosevelt in North Dakota, which is also Badlands. We don't preserve as parks the prairie around them, and we don't have anything like the tall grass prairie of Illinois and Iowa. Canada built a grasslands park or started a grasslands park in the 80s and 90s. And they're still buying land, so it's not a complete park. And they intentionally built it on the U.S. border, the border of Montana, and offered to make a international grasslands park across the Alberta-Montana border. Most of that land is public land on the U.S. side. The Canadians chose it because we had public land on that side, but it's mostly Bureau of Land Management land, which is used by livestock grazers. And they fight that idea tooth and nail. But I would say grasslands or prairies would be the big, obvious, unparked habitat in the lower 48.
Okay. Yeah, and the whole BLM and their use of things and the things they do is a whole nother topic.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for your call. Just very quickly, we're talking with Bob Parr. He's a professor of political science at the University of Illinois, talking about the national parks. And we've got a couple of callers lined up, but there's still about 14 minutes left. 333-9455 is the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area. Outside that area, 800-222-9455. And let's move on to the toll-free line, line 4, Belgium.
Oh, wow.
Hello.
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 Yes, I wanted to bring up a park that is very rarely mentioned, and that's the Boundary Waters Park, which is along the Canadian-American border in northern Minnesota. It's
yes.
not very far from here. It's a very large park, and it's related to the Quetico National Park, which is in Canada, which makes it extremely large park. It is very well used by canoeists, but their impact seems to be fairly limited. So it is a fairly wild area.
It is a wild area. It's the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness is the technical name. It's inside Superior National Forest, which is not a national park, and Quetico in Ontario is a provincial park. But those are technicalities. It looks like a national park if you were in it, in that it does have lots of wild areas. There is a national park to its west, Voyageurs National Park, that celebrates the voyageurs that canoed across the United States and Canada, and Isle Royale National Park in Lake Superior, which is a short boat ride out of Grand Portage, Minnesota from there. And that is, it's a big wild area. It's a very important wild area. It's the only place in the lower 48 that has had wolves continually since European arrival. So the wolves were not extirpated there. And those wolves have continued to disperse throughout the upper Midwest. Occasionally a wolf will try to disperse into or through Illinois, which they don't find is very hospitable, but they're coming from those populations that ultimately have expanded out of that Boundary Waters area.
Thank you very much.
Oh, yeah, you're more welcome. Okay.
All right, thank you. We have a caller on line one from Moni. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I'm a product of the National Forest. I actually, I shouldn't say a product makes me sound like a tree, but I used to work for the United States Forest Service years ago, and I spent 18 years as a firefighter / professional forester, and I see what we do to these parks. It's insane. But because I used to live in the Northwest, and I've been out here for quite a while, actually. I kind of consider myself a product of Chicagoland now, but I've seen what we've done. People in the Midwest don't realize that. They're concerned with prairies and stuff, but, I mean, when you go out and you travel and you go out, you know, say you want to go to some of these parks that you mentioned or the forest, you got to see what kind of damage is done, graffiti and the just the building damage, you know, the miscellaneous garbage. And the reason I bring this up is the Forest Service and the Park Service do not, let me repeat, they do not make a lot of money. These people who work there, like myself that used to be, you don't make a lot of money.
No, not at all.
And you're at the bottom of the totem pole. The problem is people think every government entity is evil and they ought not to get raises and not get money. And, I myself, the reason why I'm not working there anymore is because I didn't think living, you know, $25,000 or $22,000 a year before taxes economically speaking, it was almost suicide. And I know people that used to have families that they lived on $22,000 a year. And this is the last time I worked there was 92, 93.
Yeah, that's a good point. The folks in the Park Service, and probably those of you in the Forest Service say similar things, is that they say they're paid in sunsets, that they get low pay, but the benefit is that you get to get out and see beautiful country all the time. If you have a family in a national park at the time that you were in the Forest Service in the late 80s, early 90s, you could easily be below the poverty line and be receiving public assistance while you were working for the government.
I was. I mean, I got married and I decided I had to go into bigger and better things. I love that job. Let me tell you, I'd rather be doing that than being in construction right now. But it did help me. I mean, all my school and everything is wrapped around that. So when I go to making furniture or doing any kind of, you know, remodeling stuff, I know about wood and how it works. But the bottom line is I hear all these people complaining about the Park Service. They don't do this, the amount of money that they have to charge. I've seen what it's done to Yellowstone and Yosemite, especially Yosemite. They have a lot of problems with compaction around the trees. People don't adhere to the signs. I mean, you're talking about guns. I know for a fact in Sierras, for instance, they have their own Forest Service now has their own DEA agents because of the known pot farms and drug farms that they've had up in the northern Sierras, which I used to go hiking in all the time. Let's just put it this way. What I've seen in the Northwest happen, it's trash. It's like it's turning into a garbage dump. And every once in a while, National Geographic comes out with stuff that shows this. If we're supposed to be environmentally sound, how come this is going on? I don't understand it. But I want your comment. I'll get off so other people can get on. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your comments.
Thank you. Ken Burns did tell us a little bit about this, and it's been a part of the parks ever since they began. The first people to go to Yellowstone carved their initials in the geysers. They took axes to the formations and tried to cart away some of the geologic formations. I've never felt the need to do any of those things myself, so I find it a little hard to imagine. But the impact, the littering, is all very difficult issues in everywhere. And one of the issues that a lot of the callers have talked about is the human impact on parks. And I want to pull out one issue around that because it's close to all of us in Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. Again, our closest national park. Those of you who've been there know that it's actually fragmented into lots of different pieces. Mm-hmm. I don't know the full number of pieces, but I would guess about 6 or 8. The park is interspersed with 3 steel plants, a power plant, a railroad, the Dunes Highway, a bunch of hotels, and other businesses. And yet that park also has more plant species than any other national park in the country except for the Smokies and Grand Canyon.
Hmm.
So it's this remarkable reservoir of biological diversity of plants. And those plants are for the most part doing okay. It's relatively low in terms of the number of endangered and threatened plants. And it is coexisting with people. But again, if you've been up there, you know there's a lot of people that go out there and party on the weekends and use that park pretty hard. And a lot of the parks are going that way, and I like to think of Indiana Dunes as a microcosm of some of those human impact stories that we have around the national park system.
Yeah, I'm from that area myself, so I've been to Indiana Dunes pretty frequently, and I mean, never thought of it as a national park. Never even occurred to me that's what it is. Just the beach,
Go
to the beach,
and that's the main use, of course, is as a beach for the people in Indiana or Chicago coming down on the train.
Mm-hmm. We have about 7 minutes left in the program. The number right now is 333-9455, and, of course, the toll-free line 800-222-9455, so you still have a few minutes left to get in questions or comments for Bob Parr. You know, we were talking before about, well, you mentioned a couple times that there's a distinction between the national forest and the national park. What, I mean, you say if you're in it, you don't notice the distinction, but there must be some actual distinction.
Well, the national parks are managed by the National Park Service, which is in the Department of the Interior.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are in an agency that has a lot of different functions, but one of those functions is the preservation of things like national parks. Fish and Wildlife Service is also there for preserving animals or managing species. The U.S. Forest Service manages the national forests and the national grasslands. They're in the Department of Agriculture. And historically, they have always thought of forests and grasslands like someone who thinks about agriculture. How can we use these forests sustainably in a way so we can continue to get a crop year in and year out? And that means growing trees, replanting them after you log them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's much more oriented towards use, whereas the national parks, we don't have that kind of extractive use. Since the 1970s, the Forest Service has also been mandated to worry about wildlife and to worry about recreation and wilderness. So there are national forests that are managed mostly for wilderness and national forests that are managed mostly for recreation. But, you could easily walk through a national forest and see a clear cutting or see a timber harvest area, which you would not see in a national park.
Hmm. Okay, so they're not logging in the national parks now?
Right.
Okay.
And for the most part, no hunting in the national parks except in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And the Grand Teton National Park, as a result of a weird exception that Ken Burns did mention, and a couple of national preserves in Texas and in Florida, among others.
Now, this was, an interesting thing we talked about again before the show, that there's an area in Idaho, you said, where there's just no law whatsoever in a national park.
Well, there's law, but it's completely unenforceable. Yellowstone was created before Idaho became a state. And there's just a little sliver of the park that is in the state of Idaho. And if you committed a crime there, you could only be tried by a jury constituted in the county there. But there's no one that lives in that county, so it would be impossible to constitute a jury. And so, therefore, it would be impossible to convict you of anything. You could plead guilty before a judge, I suppose, but you can't be convicted by a jury of your peers. There was a murder mystery by C.J. Box that exploited this to effect in a murder mystery story. And he actually starts out telling the story of why that's true. So if you like funky little legal holes, I would refer you to that one.
So, yeah, and just, you know, might want to avoid certain areas in Idaho in your travels. When you have, of course, these different areas, national forests, national parks, you have the Forest Service and the Park Service. I guess there needs – is there a lot of cooperation there? Is there more that they could be doing to get along?
Yeah, there's a lot more.
Got about 3 minutes left, by
okay.
the way.
I can go on a lot more. That's actually the nature of my research project in the national parks is the cooperation between national parks and the folks neighboring them, which means a lot of national forests and Indian reservations and occasionally some other folks, but those are the biggest two. The wildlife don't recognize the boundaries. So the elk or the bison migrate across park boundaries in lots of places. The wolves disperse out of park boundaries. Bad things come in. Exotic plants disperse in and other things disperse out that neighbors might not like. Wolves are very visible examples of that. The Park Service and the Forest Service have both traditionally thought only in terms of between the fences. They think in terms of what goes on in our piece of land, and they don't do a very good job thinking about what goes on in their neighbors' pieces of land. Both agencies are trying to get better about that. But it's hard. They do have different mandates. Congress created them for reasons. Yellowstone is surrounded by 6 national forests. Those national forests actually fall into 3 different administrative regions of the Forest Service. And Congress created that structure because they wanted the national forests to be open for things like logging and hunting. And they didn't want the national parks to be open for those things. And those boundaries are there to reflect the will of Congress. So it's hard for the forest supervisors and the park superintendents to violate the mandates that Congress was given by trying to do things across boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at root one of the problems that they face. They try to deal with it in some cases in a very difficult political environment. Locals who care a lot about bison, elk, wolves, those charismatic species.
And we have the centennial of the National Park Service, right?
Yeah, centennial is 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the features of the Park Service is trying to celebrate the centennial of the service in 2016 with something called the Centennial Initiative,
mm-hmm.
Which is meant to be a revitalization of the parks for their second century. A lot of it right now looks like Mission 66, which
mm-hmm.
is that that road building and development project that Burns talked about in the last day. And there's a lot of money going into things. It's divided up into a lot of areas. And so if you look on the website for Centennial 2016, and I hope a lot of listeners do, you'll see it talks about things like visitor education or experiences, relationships with the parks. And then if you look to see what they're doing, it's almost always a construction job. Okay. Experiencing the park means building a visitor center. Education means building a place for school groups to visit.
Sure.
And so forth. And I'd like to think more about the restoration that Ken Burns left us with. Which things can we restore in the second century? How can we... what other things or what other directions could the Park Service go in that aren't necessarily building things?
Mm-hmm.
Are there more species that need to be reintroduced like the wolves in Yellowstone? Are there roads or visitor centers which are on top of things that shouldn't be there?
Sure.
And so forth. We have hotels on top of geysers in Yellowstone. Do we really want hotels on top of geysers? Maybe not.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a very interesting topic, and certainly I think a lot to think about. We've been talking to Bob Parr, from the professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Urbana. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me on. It's always a joy to talk about national parks.
Thanks. And this, of course, is Focus 580. I'm your guest host, David Teal. Coming up, The Afternoon Magazine with your guest host, Jason Croft.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign.
Excellent.
Trophy
well,
Time features a variety
well.
Of
you.
Items
Thanks.
Either made from recycled materials or are recyclable, like shopping bags, bag clips, and key tags. Information on their Go Green catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Orchestra de Sao Paulo with Dame Evelyn Glennie on October 14th and New Orleans' own Hot 8 Brass Band on October 16th. More information about these and other events is at KrannertCenter.com.
It's a minute before noon, and you're listening to The Afternoon Magazine here on AM 580 WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, we'll have our monthly look at Nutritia. Susan Kundrat will be in here, and Rita Schulte will be the guest host. Quickly, we'll look at the markets now. Going to Kansas City, December wheat is 464.5. That is up 5. March, 480. That is up 4.5. Moving over to Chicago, December wheat, 450.5. That's up 9.25. March, 470.25, up 9.5. Moving on to corn, December corn, 340.